Barack Obama announced that he would open vast new regions of the U.S. coastlines to offshore oil and gas drilling, in part because the environmental record of past drilling had given him confidence in the safety of that process. Just a few weeks later, BP's Macondo well, being drilled by the Deepwater Horizon rig, blew out, causing what we all know to be one of the most significant environmental disasters in recent U.S. history. Investigations into the spill, of course, found that BP and its contractors had made a series of critical mistakes and drew focus to industry practices that could not, in all cases, reliably prevent a spill. Investigators also placed blame on government regulators, whom they said had failed to fulfill the charge of aggressively overseeing the drilling process and lacked regulations that would force the best drilling practices to become routine practice. The spill highlighted a widening gap between the industry and the government that oversees it, both in terms of the regulators' ability to keep up with technological advances and to make drilling in the frontier regions like deep water and the Arctic possible, as well as their ability to find the staff and the funding to adequately police the drilling activities that happened there. In many ways, the spill forced an ongoing reevaluation of whether offshore drilling, particularly in deep water, can be done safely and whether it's worth the environmental risk. Some changes have begun in the year since then. New regulations have been written that you will hear about today. But after a brief moratorium, drilling in the Gulf has returned to pre-spill levels, and exploration in the Arctic is now also proceeding. We learned that this morning BP's supplemental exploration plan was just approved by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, and we've heard that BP will be allowed to compete for new leases in an upcoming lease sale in the Gulf of Mexico as well. So the question is, what has changed? Are we any better prepared for offshore drilling than we were before the Deepwater Horizon disaster began? And what lessons have we learned? Do we understand what the environmental consequences are for seeking energy and oil supplies offshore? We have three speakers with us today. I'll briefly introduce each of them together, and then they will each speak to you here from the podium for about 8 to 10 minutes, and then I'll look forward to your questions and discussion afterwards. Unfortunately, Michael Bromwich was not able to attend today. He had a last-minute conflict, and in his place we have Dr. Walter Cruikshank. Dr. Cruikshank is Deputy Director of what is now the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which as of just October 1st oversees exploration, permitting, and leasing in the United States, as well as environmental reviews related to those processes. After the spill in the Gulf, what was then the Minerals and Management Agency was initially split into what became the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement. The idea was to separate out sometimes conflicting functions of revenue collection, permitting, and safety and enforcement. So what we saw 2 weeks ago was a further split that was previously planned. BOMER became BOEM, and we have Dr. Cruikshank. Prior to this reorganization, Dr. Cruikshank was with the Minerals and Management Service since 2002 and previously worked with the Department of Interior for more than 25 years. Then we'll hear from Eric Melito. Eric is Director of Upstream and Industry Operations, meaning he handles regulatory and legislative issues relating to exploration and production of oil and gas for the American Petroleum Institute. The API is the industry's largest trade organization. It represents more than 400 companies. Eric is a former major in the United States Army, an attorney. He once worked in the Solicitor's Office of the U.S. Department of Interior. Since the Gulf blowout, he has testified about the industry's efforts related to the Macondo case before the House Committee on Natural Resources, the House Committee on Science and Technology, the National Commission on the Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill, and several other panels and committees. Finally, L.G. Holstein is Senior Director for Strategic Planning at the Environmental Defense Fund, where he specializes in energy policy, land, water, and wildlife management programs, with a specific focus more recently on coastal restoration processes and the impact to those coastal areas from drilling in the Gulf. Prior to joining EDF, LG was a senior advisor to the Obama presidential campaign on energy and environmental policy matters and co-director of the Department of Energy's presidential transition team. He served numerous high-level roles, including associate director of the Office of Management and Budget for Natural Resources, Energy, and Science. Also served with White House National Economic Council. It was an assistant secretary of NOAA and a former chief of staff for the U.S. Department of Energy. So with that, let me turn it over to Dr. Cruikshank for his opening remarks.
Thank you, Abram, and thank you to SEJ for putting this panel together. And good morning to all of you. Today, I'd like to highlight some of the changes that we've made since the spill and address how and why this is a new era for regulation, oversight, and environmental stewardship of the Outer Continental Shelf. One of the fundamental weaknesses highlighted by virtually every party that took a look at causes of the spill was the fact that the Minerals Management Service had three large and competing missions: revenue generation, responsible energy development, and safety and environmental protection. In May of 2010, Secretary of Interior Ken Salazar signed a secretarial order announcing his intention to separate MMS into three distinct organizations, with the goal of separating these functions and enhancing our ability to accomplish these important but quite different missions. The first group to break out was in October of 2010, and that was the Office of Natural Resources Revenue, which is responsible for collection and disbursement of all energy and mineral revenues from federal and American Indian lands, both onshore and offshore. That is now a separate office within the Department of the Interior. On October 1st of this year, just 3 weeks ago, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, and the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, or BESEE, opened their doors for business. BOEM manages environmentally and economically responsible development of the nation's offshore resources, and that's where I serve. Its functions include offshore leasing, resource evaluation, review and administration of exploration and development plans, our offshore renewable energy program, National Environmental Policy Act analyses, and our environmental studies program. In BOEM, we've created a structure that ensures sound environmental reviews are conducted and the potential environmental effects of proposed operations are given appropriate weight during decision-making. These processes must be rigorous and they must be efficient so operations can go forward in a timely way based on a thorough understanding of their potential impacts on the environment and with confidence that appropriate mitigation measures to protect against those potential impacts have been designed and put in place. We have renewed and reaffirmed our commitment to thorough, credible, and unfiltered science as a basis for our resource management decisions. To that end, we've established a new position, Chief Environmental Officer, within BOEM. This person will be empowered to represent our environmental scientists from across the nation in Washington, D.C., to help resolve disputes between leasing and environmental programs in the field, and most importantly, will have a seat at the table for all major programmatic decisions. We also expect this individual will be a major participant in setting the scientific agenda for our nation's oceans. BOEM and its predecessor agencies have long maintained a robust scientific studies program. We're refocusing our efforts to showcase the world-class science being conducted and directed by our scientists, and we're taking institutional steps to make sure the results of that research feed into our decision-making processes. Turning to the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, BESEE is responsible for the safety and environmental oversight of oil and gas operations, including permitting, inspections, and enforcements. In shaping BESEE, we took a broad look at both domestic and international regulatory agencies to identify best practices for creating strong enforcement mechanisms. One of the outcomes of this effort was, for the first time in our agency, the creation of an environmental enforcement division. This division will provide sustained regulatory oversight focused on compliance by operators with environmental regulations, lease stipulations, and mitigation measures, as well as assessing the effectiveness of those measures and meeting their intent. BESEE has also established a national training center. This training center's initial focus will be on keeping our experienced inspectors up to date on new technologies and processes being used offshore and ensuring that new inspectors are given the proper foundation for carrying out their responsibilities. And we've already run two cohorts of our newest inspectors through our initial inspector training programs. Together, the two new bureaus embody our collective efforts to institutionalize a set of structural and substantive reforms that will greatly enhance our nation's ability to responsibly develop offshore energy resources, improve the safety of operations, and provide greater environmental protection. But our changes have not been limited to reorganization and structural changes. We have also done an overhaul of our regulatory program, and that is ongoing. The Deepwater Horizon tragedy highlighted the weaknesses in MMS's regulations, particularly as they related to offshore safety. In the immediate aftermath of the spill, we found existing regulations had not kept up with technology and practices used, particularly in deep water. In response, we quickly issued new regulations that bolstered offshore drilling safety, and we've introduced performance-based standards similar to those used by regulators in the North Sea to make operators responsible for identifying and minimizing the risk associated with drilling operations. This was largely done through two new rulemakings, One of these is the drilling safety rule, which created new standards for well design, casing and cementing programs, and well control procedures and equipment, including blowout preventers. But that's a first step in the reforms of our drilling safety rules. There's a number of items that we are still working on that grew out of the report to the president after the spill, as well as some of the other external reviews. And we will shortly be initiating a new rulemaking that will propose solutions and steps to take to further improve the safety of drilling operations. The second rule is our Safety and Environmental Management Systems, or SEMS rule, which requires operators to systematically identify risks and establish barriers to those risks. It seeks to reduce the human and organizational errors that are typically among the root causes of accidents and oil spills. Last month, we proposed a follow-up to that SEMS rule to further enhance its goals and to address a number of safety concerns that were not covered by that original rulemaking. Our goal is to improve our ability to enforce the SEMS rule, to make sure the SEMS rules are operating as expected, and to make sure that they're having their intended effect of improving the culture of safety among offshore operators. We've also taken additional steps to enhance offshore safety and environmental protection, including elaborating on requirements that planning documents include well-specific blowout and worst-case discharge scenarios, and importantly, that operators demonstrate they have access to and can deploy subsea containment systems that will be sufficient to rapidly respond to deep water blowout or other loss of well control. These requirements are substantial and necessary, and many of them are long overdue. The ones we've made and the ones we're going to continue to make going forward, we think will make the enterprise of offshore exploration, development, and production safer and more responsible than ever before. Looking to the future, BOEM's agenda is to enhance our nation's energy portfolio. We are currently finalizing our proposed oil and gas leasing program for 2012-17 and its associated draft environmental impact statement. In the coming weeks, we'll be announcing public hearings related to those documents. We are also holding a Western Gulf of Mexico lease sale in December and continuing to work towards a Central Gulf of Mexico sale in the spring. We're completing a programmatic environmental impact statement for geological and geophysical operations in the Mid and South Atlantic. There's been more than 20 years since large-scale seismic work has been done in that region, and this will greatly add to our knowledge about the potential magnitude and location of resources in the Atlantic. Also, we're pushing forward with our initiatives to make offshore wind energy development a reality. We'll soon be completing an environmental assessment of Mid-Atlantic wind energy areas, and we're working closely with states along the Atlantic coast to start a commercial leasing process. And as noted in the moderator's comments, we are continuing to work on reviewing exploration and development plans, both in the Gulf of Mexico as well as proposed activities in the Arctic, all of those subject to the new requirements that we have put in place. All of us involved in creating our two new agencies, BOEM and BESI, have worked to create a structure and to obtain the resources needed to fulfill our responsibilities to the American public. We need to approach environmental reviews and regulatory enforcement in a way that is tough but fair, which places safety above all else, and which ensures that responsible development of our energy resources are balanced with reasonable steps taken to protect the fragile coastal and marine environment. It's been a very difficult and challenging year and a half for everyone involved with offshore energy development in the United States. As I look back, I'm proud of what the employees of BOEM and BESI have accomplished over the past year and a half, and I'm optimistic about what lies ahead. I firmly believe we can move forward safely and responsibly to provide the needed energy for our nation. Thank you.
Thank you. So Eric Melito from the American Petroleum Institute.
I think it's small enough to hear me. I don't know if I need to use the microphone, but thank you for providing the opportunity to come speak. This is a book conference, and I think it's good to be able to share some information and have a dialogue about the future for offshore. First thing I'd like to say is the oil and gas industry supports having strong, effective regulations in place. You need to have a strong regulator that's fully resourced to do the environmental reviews, to do the lease sales, to issue permits, and then to hold the companies accountable for enforcement, compliance, and inspection. We need that in place. But it's also important for us to highlight the industry's commitment to continuous improvement, making sure we're doing it right. Since the spill, the industry has been very active in several areas. And those areas are safety and environmental management systems, which Walter alluded to in the SEMS programs. The second area is prevention, having drilling containers in place that allow you to prevent 90% of what we do, from even more than that, 99% is focused on making sure that we are preventing anything from ever occurring in the first place. Third area is intervention. In the unlikely event that we have a spill, a blowout, anything, you know, the level we saw in our condo, or even a lower level than that, we want to make sure we can quickly get out there and cap and contain the well. And then the fourth area is spill response, making sure we have a strong toolkit in place so we can go out and have the tools available to do the best we can to clean up any spill that could occur. On the SEMS area, the safety environmental management systems, API put together a standard several years back on how you put together a SEMS program. And since the spill, we've actually gone out and created what's called the Center for Offshore Safety, which is really the focal point for the industry to work together on safety and environmental management systems so that all the companies involved, not just the operator holds a lease, but the drilling contractors, the cement companies, they're all working together to have an integrated system in place to make sure that everybody knows what risks are identified, how we're going to manage change, the event decisions are going to be changed, and also who's accountable throughout the process. We think it's important as we move forward, and we'll be looking to get that information not only to the industry to make improvements on lessons learned and good practices that are out there to feed that information to the government as we move forward. On the prevention side, we've been working very hard on drilling standards, and we've seen a couple of big areas where we think there's going to be tremendous improvement. And having redundancies in your well design is one. It's a new requirement that the government has, and it's suggestions we made to the government, but we're coming out with a recommended practice 96, which will be a guideline on everything you have to consider drilling a water well. So having multiple barriers in place, mechanical barriers, natural barriers, as well as testing the well. As you go through and you're drilling well, you have pressure testing in place, both negative and positive, to make sure that you're reading your test right, to make sure that in the event that you see abnormalities, you're shutting that well in and going back and starting from scratch, and making sure that you have all the safety measures in place to prevent possible spill. Another area in terms of prevention is secondary controls. There was a lot of attention on after the B2 spill and watching the video in terms of shutting that thing in. And we have new standards that we'll be seeing in place, new regulatory requirements for making sure that in the event you have a disconnect, in the event you have a breakdown of communication, you have automatic shutting of the well preventer. The next area is capping containment. Two companies have been set up by the industry, the Marine Well Containment Company and Helix Well Containment Group. If you're going to get a deep water permit, you have to be a member of one or the other, because through that, you're showing that you meet the new requirements for containment. And what we have now are capping stacks in place. These are huge devices that can be deployed within 24 hours to get out to your site, and instead of having to activate something from scratch like that, like happening in BP, we're now ready to go, ready to get out there and to be dropped on top of the well, either to shut it in or to eventually be able to provide a flow to the vessels on the surface so that you have no oil getting into the environment. The last area is spill response. It's an area where we have to continue to make improvements. We understand that everywhere from planning all the way through to the communication during spill and all the way through to making sure that we understand how this person works the best and how in-situ burning and the mechanical recovery efforts work the best. But there are many efforts in place. Shell Oil Company had XPRIZE, a program where they gave an award to the company with the best mechanical recovery system that actually cleaned the most oil out of the water. That company got received a grant to continue their work. And then the industry's working together to assess all these tools, the toolkit that I referenced. And then we're also working internationally with folks in Europe to make sure that we're working globally to create the best system in place for spill response. One thing I'd like to talk about a little bit is API started out as a standards organization in 1919 after World War I. We realized that we need consistency across the industry. And back then it had to do with making sure that the resin drill pipes fit together so you could have an operation. But since then, we've created over 500 documents, close to 600, 240 related to offshore exploration. And right before and right around the time of this spill, we created a new standard on cementing. It's called Recommended Practice 65 Part 2, which in just 4 months after the spill, it was updated to a standard and changed a lot of wording in there from should do things to must do things, based upon the need to make sure that, you know, it's a requirement and not just a deferential decision to a company. We have blowout preventer standards. Those are being revised. There are standards for remotely operated vehicles. Those are the base container-sized vessels that go down and are used to do servicing on operations, as well as to shed in a blowout preventer. But I point this out, you know, we're not told to do this. The industry has had a commitment to continuous improvement since the 20s when we were working together to put these systems in place. 20 years before, you know, the blowout, we had the semi stock out there for companies to use. And the good thing is government regulators, well, adopted around the world, domestically in the States, references to these documents exceed 200 times internationally outside the U.S. and the United States. It's over 100 times at state level. Regulatory programs over 3,000 times across the country. So if the regulators see a strong document in place, they'll reference it. And if not, you know, companies use these to train and to use in their own operations voluntarily. Moving forward, if you look at EIA, we're going to have significant increases in renewable energy. And this industry is part of that answer. It says the oil and gas industry, for every $5 spent on renewables, the oil and gas industry spends one of those dollars. So $105 is spent by the oil and gas industry. And we see that in companies who are the leading geothermal producers, the leading wind energy investors, solar, LG to fuel, lithium batteries. It's this industry doing it, but we can't forget that their focus is oil and gas. That's where they make a profit. Oil and gas, these are, you know, companies that, you know, have investors out there expecting a profit being made, so oil and gas. But if you look at EIA, even with the significant advancements and significant increase in renewables, you know, the projection through 2035 is we're going to need more oil and gas. So the question from a policy standpoint is, where do we get it from? And the offshore right now produces about 25-30% of our domestic oil. Do we, you know, cast that aside? Or do we let it get produced around the world in other areas? I'm not sure. I believe we have a strong environmental regulatory program in place. We had disasters. We had unprecedented events. And our role is to reduce the risks so much that we don't see that happen again. We don't want to see that happen. It's not good business. Good business is environmental and safety performance. Safety and environmental performance is good business. We believe that as an industry. So we want to move forward to making sure we don't have an event like that. So our commitment has to drive toward that. So in closing, I would just like to say that we do want to be part of the solution. We do want to continue to work forward and make sure that we don't have this type of incident again. But I think our energy future, from a practical standpoint, demands that we actually look to develop resources here where we have strong mechanisms in place and get the benefits of those for our economy. 14 million people unemployed right now. We create a lot of jobs without subsidies being thrown our way. So we think it's a win-win. But we understand a lot of concerns, and we have to address them.
Thank you. Thank you, Eric. L.G. Holstein from the Environmental Defense Fund.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here. Nice to be here with my colleagues. Walter Cruikshank is one of those people who many of you may not know, but those of us who work in Washington on these issues have known about his expertise and careful attention to the public interest for many years. Eric and I have actually done this roadshow a couple of times now. In fact, we are going to collaborate going forward on a collection of jams and jellies, which will be available afterward for any of you who may be so inclined.
I'll provide the petroleum jellies. So.
We're still. We're
that was
still,
not planned. I'm sorry.
We're still. I kind of served that right up. We're still arguing over the name. Okay. So I want to say a few things about what I refer to as the Macondo mythology. Some of the outstanding things that were said and assumed during the spill, and I think it's worth going over them because we will undoubtedly face crises like this again, including probably blowouts, hopefully not nearly as bad. But in the world of resource extraction and in sort of the broader world of our industrial economy, we will face large-scale industrial accidents again in the future. And so I think it's useful to keep our eye on what we said when it was all going on and what we did, what we failed to do. So let me mention my top three or four items under Macondo mythology. I think you probably have some of your own. First is that new regulations coming from the government would raise costs to the industry to the point where the Gulf of retrieval of oil and gas resources from the Gulf of Mexico would no longer be economically viable. I think the recent interest in the lease sales, the ongoing relatively high prices for oil, continue to remind us that the oil companies will go where the oil is and will continue to seek to do so and will be able to and strive to meet new regulatory requirements, presumably reasonably considered, and will be able to adapt both their technology and their responses to the regulatory regimes in ways that will enable America, as the Department of Energy has said and projected, to continue to rely heavily on the Gulf of Mexico for America's oil and gas, much of America's oil and gas production. The second piece of mythology is that no harm was really done to the environment, that the oil kind of magically disappeared. Nobody seems quite certain where it went. It's very clear that only a small portion of it was collected, which is typically the case out in open water. We learned that in the Exxon Valdez, where all these years later there are still oil deposits in that region as a result of that terrible oil spill. This, of course, was many, many times larger. In this case, we applied all kinds of exotic dispersants, the effects of which we knew, about which we knew just about nothing. This is a region of the country that is the nursery to a huge percentage of our fishing industry. The Gulf is the region where the oil and gas industry, the shipping industry, and incredibly diverse environmental interests all come together. And so to assume simply that because we can't see the oil that there's no long-lasting harm is jumping to a conclusion, which I hope will end up being correct, but I somehow doubt it. And so one of the things that I think is desperately needed is an ongoing scientific evaluation that carefully monitors what goes on with the shellfish, what goes on with the wetlands, which we're already losing at the rate of about a football field every 40 minutes in the last major remaining wetlands in the United States, specifically along coastal Louisiana. The third piece of mythology is that the blowout was a freak accident, that it was actually a larger version of something that's very common. While there's some truth in that, the sheer scale of this thing reminds us that we need to bear in mind the findings of the Oil Spill Commission that said, no, this was not just a couple of operators who were asleep at the switch. There were actually a widespread cultural problems, managerial problems, and that they are not confined to BP, were not confined to BP and its contractors, but rather were industry-wide, and they did not spare the Department of Interior either for being too reliant on the industry. And the final one I'll mention in my list of Macondo myths is that the government and the industry knew how to handle the blowout. The government made a big show of sending senior government officials down to the Gulf who were going to take charge of things, who were going to tell us exactly how much oil was coming out, assemble fancy scientists from all around the globe who were going to help solve the problem. The truth of the matter is that the government was largely, very nearly wholly reliant on the industry to come up with the solutions to the problem. The government was ill-equipped and did not have at its disposal the expertise necessary to actually make determinations about what should and shouldn't be done. It is true that the government did render some decisions, had to, on some issues like the dispersants that were used, But they did so on the basis of very little information and certainly no plan for any sort of interagency reaction to this problem. So I think that the government deserves a lot of credit for assembling a large team. But in the end, we all have to confront the central fact that the government, as well as the industry, were unprepared. And I will take some blame on behalf of the environmental community. It took us far too long to realize the scale of this particular disaster. We were slow in coming to grips with the idea that we were looking at a historic environmental catastrophe. And most of the people in the environmental community do not have the expertise to render particularly useful judgments about drilling safety. And that's why it's so important that we learn some central lessons from this terrible tragedy. Let me mention just three or four of the lessons. There are many lessons learned listed in the commission's report, but there are some that I think that that I in particular would like to highlight from the standpoint of the environmental community. Second is, and you've heard Walter talk about this at some length, the need to separate, if you will, we must separate the leasing from the policing. And there were have been many discussions about exactly how to do that. Former Secretary of Interior Babbitt recommended that they actually should be separated completely outside of the Department of Interior. That is to say, the leasing and the safety and environmental oversight should actually not even be within the house, within the same governmental department. Second, as I've already indicated, we were and the government was far too reliant on industry. Third, and this is, I think, a critically important lesson. Regulators tend to fall behind the curve when you're dealing with a continuously evolving set of technologies, and that's exactly what we face in the offshore domain. And I think this is particularly a useful thing to bear in mind when we consider that the Arctic may be where oil and gas development accelerates in the years to come. And what I'm referring to here is simply that when all of the TV cameras and reporters have packed up and gone home, we will see this industry pushing into deeper and deeper waters with ever more complex operating environments, and the technology necessary to keep up with those challenging conditions will continue to evolve, and therefore the regulatory oversight and the expertise on the part of the government must keep up as well, and that will be a central challenge to stay on the job as the years go forward and this tragedy begins to fade into memory. So we do need redundant safety systems. And I also want to say that I think the department has made a very good decision in adopting the notion that one way for the regulators to keep up is by actually convening outside and requiring outside validation, that is to say, certification by independent entities of key pieces of drilling equipment, that is to say, will they actually work? Will this piece of equipment actually work on this well, like it's supposed to and when it's needed? And that's been done in the nuclear weapons industry. It's been done in the commercial nuclear power industry. It's been done in the commercial industry. And now I think we're seeing the beginnings of a similar kind of approach with respect to offshore drilling. So I'll wrap up simply by saying that among the actions that are still needed, and perhaps we'll talk more about those, are one very important one and one hopeful sign of congressional bipartisanship. And that is the fact that we have the so-called Restore Act, Democrats and Republicans coming together saying we should dedicate 80% of the Clean Water Act penalties, which could range to as high as $20 billion, to Gulf Coast restoration. And there's been a lot of support for that, at least in high concept. The question is whether or not in an era of incredibly tight budgets, whether or not the Congress will allow that to happen. But we must address the ongoing degradation made worse by the oil spill by dedicating those penalties to coastal restoration. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, before I open up to questions, I'm going to selfishly take the first myself. Given this morning's news of the approval of BP supplemental exploration plan in the Gulf of Mexico, I'd like to ask you, Dr. Cruikshank. BP in particular is a company with the equivalent of four past criminal convictions, a record of problems in the Gulf, and there's an ongoing criminal investigation still into their conduct in the Gulf, at the same time that the EPA and your agency and others are still considering whether or not the company should be debarred from future government contracts in the United States, which would include lease sales. The decision was made a few days ago to allow them to go forward with the upcoming lease sale in December, and then this morning the approval of their new drilling plan. So I'd like to ask you what, if any, special consideration was given in making this decision that was announced today, whether or not BP should be allowed to move forward so quickly. And in general, at what point does a specific company's behavior warrant special consideration or possible temporary or long-term disqualification from the privilege of drilling in U.S. territories?
Well, first I would start by saying that BP is subject to all of the new requirements that we have put in place, both around plans and permitting, and what was approved was a plan. It does not, at this point, BP does not have any permits to drill the wells in those plans. In addition to meeting our new requirements, BP made some voluntary commitments about things they would do, some at the plan stage, some at the permit stage, that are over and above the regulatory requirements and which, by agreement with us, will be enforceable. So in that regard, I think that, you know, we're holding BP to not only our new standards, but in some respects a higher standard for the operations they go forward with. As of this time, BP is still legally qualified to hold a lease and to be an operator. You're right, there's ongoing investigations. There's ongoing legal processes. I'm not going to guess how those turn out. But I think that both in the work we've seen in that exploration plan and the work that BP has done over the past many months, that there's certainly a strong effort on their part to perform better in the future than they have in the past. With respect to your broader comment about when should we say to a company they're no longer qualified, we do have that authority to tell a company they can no longer be an operator if they systematically and continually are unable to meet our regulatory requirements and improve their performance. We sit down with every company every year and go through their performance offshore in terms of what their compliance rates have been and what our inspectors have found. You know, it's a tool that we have. I think the issue around BP, because of the ongoing litigation, is one that really needs to run through that process rather than purely through our regulatory oversight.
And when you make that consideration, do you look at a company's conduct in other places outside of the Gulf of Mexico or outside of offshore drilling?
Our meetings with the companies are really about their performance on the outer continental shelf.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Well, let's open it up to questions. A quick review of the rules. Journalists and SEJ members, please, and please be succinct, as I would also ask of our panelists here. So go ahead.
Seth Bornstein, AP. Just to follow up on Abraham's question, Mr. Cruikshank, you said you're only looking at the oil, you know, offshore. So if a company like BP, which has a large record of violations in refineries, why don't you bring in non-offshore issues there? I mean, you talk to Chemical Safety Board, they call BP a repeat violator. And for for Eric, in terms of this, right after the spill, the industry was painting BP as a rogue operator. This is not the industry. This is just one bad company that has had its problems. Is it more a rogue issue, or and how can one of the top companies be sort of a rogue? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Want me to go first? Or you?
Either way, I will answer your question to me first. I think in part the reason we don't look at what companies have performed elsewhere, whether overseas or onshore or in different lines of business, it's because we don't really have any jurisdiction there. So we aren't in a position to really get to the bottom of what performance is in various parts of a company that we don't interact with on a regular basis. So we focus on those areas where we have regulatory jurisdiction, where we have the detailed information on what performance is, and where we can have some meaningful, constructive conversations about what needs to be done to improve performance.
Yeah, from the industry standpoint, we looked at this as being an isolated event, an unprecedented event, and that's based upon the track record of the industry in the Gulf of Mexico, where you look at over 40,000 wells being drilled, over 2,000 in deep water, and then when you look broader around the globe, you've seen a similar record. So it's not something that happens frequently, and this event itself, as we all know, was a disaster of unprecedented proportions that we haven't seen before. But in many respects, we also saw an unprecedented response with over 40,000 people, over close to 10,000 vessels, and one thing we heard was an ineffective government industry response. I think the problems were around capping and containment, but overall, if you heard Thad Allen, the commander of the Incident Response Center, talk repeatedly in the past about how it did follow the plans and the tools were put into place. It's just that it's ugly when you have an oil spill offshore. You are going to have environmental damage, and that's the problem we have, but we have to learn to improve from that. So from our standpoint, it's just kind of putting the history out there and making sure folks realize that this is not something that has occurred on a frequent basis, and that was the point we've been making, that this particular instance was a lot of decisions that were made. And if you look at BP's own report, it highlights 8 different decisions, any one of which could have potentially prevent that from happening. So we just got to make sure that we have the redundancies and risk mitigation measures in place that prevent that from happening ever again.
So I guess the question was, is BP rogue, or are they representative of the oil industry?
I would not characterize them as rogue, and I would not characterize that event as being representative of the industry.
Please.
Howard Salicy, Environmental News. I'm just so thoroughly confused because I have empathy for each of these three gentlemen. I understand their spin stories, but I'm absolutely aghast that so much has happened so rapidly, and yet nothing has been placed after a year and a half before the president. But it's amazing how many wonderful suggestions make things more error-free now because of the pressure. And I seem to recall very recently that the administration will permit zero problems. And yet I hear Eric speaking about we can never guarantee zero problems, but and on we go, and on and on and on.
And do you have a question for him about that?
No, it's just a statement. I have 20 questions, but I didn't want to take more time than I thought that I deserved.
Okay. Thank you. Please.
Elizabeth Rosen, freelance journalist. I guess the first thing is Mr. Cruikshank. As part of response to any future oil spills, are there any plans in place to revisit the National Contingency Plan, which when it comes to some of the response tools, particularly in the area of dispersants, frames up what the technologies are that can be used, and are there any plans in place to revisit what is currently on the National Contingency Plan product list, and if not, what would need to happen to expand the tools that you have through the National Contingency Plan?
Well, the National Contingency Plan and that whole structure is really under the jurisdiction of the Coast Guard. Coast Guard is looking at that. They've pulled together all the federal agencies involved in spill response and are reviewing the entire spill response program and thinking about what steps to take in the future. But I can't really speak to what the Coast Guard's plans are specifically. The other thing I want to note is Secretary Salazar last year created an Ocean Energy Safety Advisory Committee that's made up of experts from academia, from non-governmental organizations, from industry, from other federal agencies. It's chaired by Tom Hunter, the ex-director of Sandia National Labs. It's got a lot of very good minds on it. That committee is looking, has broken into 4 subcommittees, looking at prevention, at spill response, at spill containment, and at safety management systems. So in response to your question, spill response is on the table for them, and they're really taking a very aggressive agenda in trying to figure out what other things need to happen in the future to enhance the overall safety and environmental protection picture offshore.
If I could just respond on a couple of these things, but first, Sean reminded me that while we don't have jams and jellies available yet, there are some briefing materials in the back, particularly about the legislation I was referring to for Gulf Coast restoration. On the issue of barring BP, I think that decision will have to await the outcome of the criminal proceedings that are underway and about which nobody really knows much at this point. But obviously the findings of the Justice Department in that regard will have, I think, bear some considerable weight with respect to the decision-making of the Department of Interior. The Ocean Energy Safety Advisory Committee that Walter referred to is exactly the kind of external oversight with lots of expertise that's non-governmental, that isn't subject to the whims of administrations that come and go, hopefully, and does reflect exactly the kind of oversight that we have in nuclear waste management and nuclear weapons management, as well as chemical safety. And lastly, I'd say with respect to the National Contingency Plan question, I think there's a lot of confusion about what was in the plan and what was not in the plan and how the plans are going to be changed. I think this is a central challenge for the Interior Department now in a couple of respects. One is to start working much more collaboratively, as they have committed to do, particularly with NOAA, in the review of NEPA documents, for example. The Commission found that the NEPA review process was anemic at best, and the availability of appropriate equipment is another area, and so we welcome the collaborative that's now been formed in the industry to come up with the equipment. Eric mentioned this before, but it is a fact that when this spill happened, there wasn't even enough of the sort of the basic containment devices that could be deployed. There certainly were not any capping stacks. As we saw, the nation waited about 3 weeks simply while the industry rushed to construct one device after another that, as we know, failed. And that kind of a lack of preparation should never, ever happen again. And so contingency plans need to reflect worst-case assumptions. They need to require a suite of response tools that are matched to and appropriate for the scale of technical complexity on any particular lease development process.
Thank you.
Roger Archibald, the SEJ. It's kind of an engineering question, I guess. To Eric, you mentioned these new capping devices that you've created that can be deployed immediately. It seems to be one of the big problems with the Macondo was once the platform collapsed and sank, there was an awful lot of debris that had to be removed before they could even try to cap it. Is there a contingency in place for debris removal as well as capping at this time?
Yeah, that's something that would be considered as part of your overall containment plan and a process you have in place to bring out the capping stack. And part of that is also making sure that we have the ROVs in place that can go down there and move that debris. Another problem was the riser didn't separate, which made it much more difficult. So, we're working to make sure that we have the capability to have the riser separate so we can get the capping stack on. So these are all parts of your plans that ultimately must be approved by the government before you can get a permit. So the industry understands these are issues that have to be addressed before going through operations.
Yeah, Stephen Hansen from the National Danish Museum, also a member of ICJ. Eric Millader, I'll just bring forth another myth that you might sort of clear up for us. Can you tell me, we all know that it's all out of eye, out of mind, so to say, and that's why we tend to forget what's happening. And most probably that's also the reason why all these dispergents were used. Is it true that a lot of dispergents were brought in from UK, where it's legal to use it for hospitals in the North Sea, but it was spread all over the Gulf of Mexico?
I don't know directly where the dispersants all came from. What I can say is, you know, LG was talking about this a bit, but, you know, the way the plan is designed to occur is that you cascade in all the resources. So the use of dispersants throughout that process, the effort was to bring them in from perhaps all around the world. I don't know exactly what manufacturers they are being purchased from, but when you have a spill of that magnitude, you're going to try to make sure you get the resources in place so you can effectively respond to it. So I don't know the details about whether or not they were purchased in the UK to that degree, but I do know that resources were brought in from all around the world to help respond to this spill.
And I think that was a good thing. During the crisis, there was a lot of there was a great deal of misinformation, for example, that the Jones Act was prohibiting needed supplies from reaching the Macondo well site. That was completely untrue. But a word or two about the dispersant. The dispersant that was used primarily is called Corexit. Supplies were brought in from different places around the world as well as from the United States. And the point I want to make about dispersants, in addition to the comments I already made about the unknown impacts on the environment, are that the government, specifically EPA, had done some testing on dispersants and had done some testing on Corexit. What they had not done was tested Corexit on the type of oil that was being produced and then was that would have been produced and was spewing from the Macondo well site. And so that meant that they truly had no baseline information about not only the environmental impacts, but even the efficacy of Corexit with respect to the particular type of crude oil that was being that was spewing from the well site. All of that, of course, are things that hopefully are changing now with EPA now directed to do much more extensive testing and the Interior Department requiring that these dispersants be appropriate. But we need to know a lot more about the impact of dispersants because the primary effect of the dispersants was biologically was to create a vast subsurface cloud, if you will, of drifting goo, often in the shape of tiny droplets, many of which, I don't want to state this categorically, but the assumption in a lot of the scientific community is that those droplets eventually made their way down and settled on coral formations, for example. It is equally possible, however, that that those clouds of dispersed oil continued to sort of float in the mid-column and are still out there in one form or another. One piece of good luck, of course, if we can say that such a thing, is that the spill occurred in the warm waters of the Gulf, so there is a lot of bacterial activity there that can help break down the oil. But these are examples of things that were not known at the time and about which very little is known now. Please.
Yeah, my name is Marilyn Heim, and I'm with the Pew Environment Group. I'm the director of the U.S. Arctic Program. And I just wanted to point out that about 80 bills were introduced in Congress this year, and last year, mostly last year, on the spill, and none of them passed, in part because of API's opposition to those bills. There's been excellent work, I think, by the department. I mean, unbelievable improvements in safety, but there still hasn't been spill response standards. No regulations have been improved since spill. There has been on containment, on safety, but not on spill response. This SEMS regs that were passed were opposed by API for the last 20 years.
They were not opposed by API. If you read our comments, they say that a better approach would be to adopt our full standard rather than adopting just four or six elements. It doesn't make sense, and it provides a confusing regulatory scheme if you're only adopting a part of a standard. So our recommendation also was to adopt our full standard, which is now part of the federal regulations.
And now I fear that one of the things that API is really pushing is a panacea of dispersants, because it looked as if dispersants had a big impact on the Gulf spill. In the Arctic, dispersants are very problematic for many reasons. And, there really is an Arctic standard. So we would like to see API, and would API be willing to work with us on standards for the Arctic, specifically for safety, prevention, and response, as well as improving the spill response regulations that have not been looked at in a very long time, especially since the pandemic.
That's certainly a possibility. You can go back and give me your card. We can try to set something up. The other thing I would just add is that from a it's been mentioned that these are suggestions, but as was just described, these are regulations in place, and we have concern about making something the law when you have a regulatory agency out there already undertaking its regulatory responsibilities and coming out with the requirements at that level. They are able to adapt and make changes, whereas you can have a very difficult time changing a law, which can be very prescriptive and could actually increase risk. So when you're doing it through a statute, there are risk consequences that could be unintended. When you do it through the regulatory framework, you're able to shape it and adapt it through time. So we want to make sure that we're not increasing risk when the ultimate goal is to decrease it.
Let me sort of follow up on that a little bit, Eric. You spoke a lot about best practices as an anti-regulatory solution or as an alternative solution, and while all changes, I think, are welcome and are improvements, and one of the things we saw in the Macondo disaster was BP's failure to follow practices that they had long identified as their own best practices, cementing above for 500 feet above the hydrocarbon zone, for example, in their well. So what now should we expect would be different about an industry-wide pledge to use best practices and present those best practices as a solution to the risks that are now more clear after the disaster last summer?
That's been occurring at several levels. I mentioned a couple documents we're developing, a recommended practice on deep water well design, and we've invited the government to be a part of that process, and we would encourage them to make that part of the regulation and one of their requirements. We've also seen our cementing standard incorporated into the regulations since this occurred. So we're creating documents that are effective and are in many cases pretty robust, and that can be utilized in the regulatory framework, and this work continues. Another area is on the safety and environmental management system area, where we have that guidance document in place, but we're also creating a bridging document. So that is dedicated to what an operator has to have in place, but we cannot forget about a drilling contractor and a cementing company out there. So we're creating a bridging document so that all the companies can look and sign on to the same document and say, this is how we're going to manage it as an integrated approach with all the companies in place. So we invite the government to be part of that. These go through a process that's accredited through the American National Standards Institute. We have third parties participate. So we're moving forward, just as we have in the past, with developing these documents with the ultimate hope that they're used by all of industry, and if not, at the same time, they can be adopted into regulation by the government.
But I guess the question is, how do you ensure that companies will use them when they already know and have accepted that they are best practices and they remain voluntary?
I'm actually going to steal the microphone to answer that point. What we have done and will continue to do is to upgrade our regulations. If we think a best practice is truly a best practice, we'll incorporate it into the regulations, and then it becomes enforceable. So some of the new requirements we put in place are requiring these independent certifications to make sure well designs are actually following best practices. SIMS, people talk about SIMS as being out there in companies before, but not all companies have had it, and it's never been enforceable as to how they carried it out. This is now a regulatory standard, and we've gone beyond the API recommended practice there by adding additional elements to further strengthen SIMS programs, and it's now an enforceable rulemaking, and if they're not doing it, you know, there'll be a penalty for not doing so. So I think that that's an important component of where something is truly a best practice, incorporating it into the regulations so that it does become enforceable and not simply a voluntary choice on the operator's part.
But for me to answer your question, you know, we leave the regulation to the regulator, and we think our performance and our commitment as an industry is evident in this work that's being done on a voluntary basis.
Chris William, MiamiPlanet.org. My question, I guess, is for all three of you. It seems as though a lot of these plans are reactive to what happened. My question is, what kind of proactive measures will be put in place to prevent this from ever happening again, like some of you have mentioned before?
I'll start by saying part of what we're trying to do, and it's a major responsibility or role we're putting on the Ocean Energy Safety Advisory Committee, is to think about just those sorts of questions. Well, you know, we don't want to be responding to the last incident because the next one will look different. So we're tasking that committee, as well as our own engineers and experts internally, to think about what other scenarios are, what other things should we be worried about, so we can be thinking about those in advance and try and address them in advance. Clearly no one has perfect foresight. There are no guarantees. You cannot eliminate risk. What we do is try to manage risk and reduce it to a level where the public writ large is willing to accept a level of risk in return for the benefits of the activity. But our goal is to continue to be proactive and aggressively try and figure out what residual risks are and try to address them to the best of our ability.
And one thing I would say is, you know, the Secretary Salazar pulled a lot of the oil company leadership into Washington and said, you know, you guys have expertise, you guys have the ability to kind of look at the system and put into place essentially enhancements to the system. So really, just a couple weeks after the incident, I think it was the first week of May, we had a joint industry task force put in place. And at that point, we didn't have all the facts coming out of this situation. So we had 30 to 40 folks on two different groups, one on equipment, one on operating procedures, to say, hey, let's look across the industry and what can be done without even considering what happened here, and make some recommendations to the Interior Department on how they can enhance the regulations. So while it was reactive, it was without the benefit of the ultimate investigations, and so those recommendations were made, and a lot of that ended up being in the regs. Outside of that, the industry works together on joint industry projects to do risk assessments, things like that. You know, we have tools that are now in place, but we want to make sure that risk is being addressed in the best fashion. Are we assessing it from the soup to nut standpoint, so that, you know, we're not just looking in isolation, that we're looking at the whole system? So you're going to see joint industry projects coming out, looking at risk over time to make sure that we can feed this information to the regulator to make sure that we're addressing it on a systems-based approach. Which that's been one of the main lessons. We got to look at this as a full system. All the elements of the system were being looked at, but we have to look at it as a whole, which is why SEMS is so important.
Just ask for your brevity so we have time to get to one or two more questions.
You can have my brevity. So I'll just make this a small additional point, which is that I think the biggest challenge looking forward is actually what's going to happen in the Arctic. If we design a whole bunch of response protocols that are focused on what we've learned in the Gulf of Mexico, I can pretty well assure you that we will have failed the test of preparing for the challenges we will face, and they are extreme in every sense of the word in the Arctic.
Thank you. Gentleman in the back.
Yes, David Guggenheim with the Ocean Foundation. Just wanted to pick up on Mr. Christine's remarks regarding the sinking of the oil, and just add that it has been documented that much of that oil did sink and resulted in the death of large areas of water corals. That's been documented over the last year. And that does lead to a question to the administration. Many of us in the scientific community were very alarmed at the widespread use of dispersants, particularly at depth, at the wellhead, which has never been done before. And in our opinion, had no basis in science. The only rationale we could see was that it would prevent the oil from going to the surface where it could be cleaned up. It's mechanically impossible to clean up oil that's been dispersed subsurface. We distributed a scientific consensus letter on this during the incident. But I guess the question is, if a similar spill occurred this afternoon, would the administration consider use of dispersants at depth at the well as it did?
Walter.
I guess this is the only one from the government on this panel. The question comes to me. Though we would not, you know, the use of dispersants would be a joint decision between the National Incident Commander and EPA that actually regulates the decisions on dispersants. You know, there's a lot of studies going on to try and look at what actually happened from Deepwater Horizon to try and understand, you know, was that a good approach or not. The results of those studies aren't all in yet. So I think that the folks in charge of making those decisions would have to look at what they're confronting. And clearly with Macondo, everybody is confronting something they really hadn't fully anticipated and planned for. And so there are a lot of things being tried to see what can we do to address this catastrophe. What the specifics will be when and if there's another major spill is possible to predict, but it's going to be up to the folks in charge at that point in time to try and put together the strategies that best fit the circumstances they're in.
We have about 3 or 4 more minutes left. I'm going to try to keep it to reporters. Does anybody else have additional questions? Steve?
Yeah, coming back to the Arctic, and I guess this might be you again. Do you think that the industry feels kind of a collective responsibility for the Arctic and the oil drilling there, the environment? And if you do, I wonder why you don't push up a lot of oil spill response to the Arctic, because it's completely insufficient for the time being. That's a fact, if something is happening. And I don't think you have any luck with the dispersant either there.
Well, the industry as a whole, I think, has been operating in the Arctic for actually decades, and even in Alaska and Canada, we've I think 150 wells have been drilled, and so it's not a new area for the industry to operate. When it comes to having the resources in place for the new projects that are being proposed for the U.S. Arctic, I think the first place to look is at the plans that have been submitted by Shell, where they're outlining the resources that are in place, and they've actually put in their plans resource capabilities above and beyond what the regs require. So in terms of ice-breaking ships, in terms of vessels, mechanical recovery, capping and containment, all these resources have been identified, and when their plan is approved, it's because they have committed those resources. So I think what it comes down to is having a strong regulatory regime in place that has these requirements, but also seeing that the companies are committing the resources to operate there, and in the event there is any kind of incident, they can react to it appropriately. There's a lot of promise in the Arctic in terms of the economic and resource benefits, and if we're going to move forward there, we got to make sure we're doing it right. I think you've seen upwards of 5,000 studies done, and we got to continue to study it. But if it's going to happen, we got to make sure we have the resources. So, to that point, I agree, and I think the industry is on an individual and a industry-wide basis trying to make it happen.
If I can just underscore that point, that for someone to be able to drill in the Arctic or anywhere else, they have to have an approved oil spill response plan in place, and they have to show that they have access to be able to deploy that equipment quickly. So whether it's in the Arctic now or not, that equipment will be in the Arctic before a well is spud. The debate can always be of whether what's been approved is enough for all the potential scenarios, but that's on us to try and make sure that it is.
One of the points I didn't get to in my presentation and sort of my list of things we have to do next is none of this will mean very much if we are not able to provide the Department of Interior with the resources it needs to actually carry out its obligations here. And Congress has been slow not only in enacting the drilling safety legislation that we frankly would like to see so that it puts in statute many of these regulatory approaches, but it also has not provided anywhere near the level of resources that the administration has said will be needed going forward. Walter, I don't know if you have any comments about that, but I do think that's a critical, you know, one hates to talk about budgets all the time, but let's face it, the regulatory regime now in place is so much more elaborate than the one that existed before, for good reason, and good and obvious reasons, but it will take money to make it go.
Walter, could you just address that quickly? We have about a minute left as the music cues on the radio interview, your 30-second response.
And thank you, Elgin, for raising that point. We have gotten additional resources in the past year, which we are putting to good use, but the President's budget requests a lot more, and our ability to do everything that we want to do, that we've told the public we plan to do, will depend on getting the resources to deliver on those commitments, and we won't know that until we get a budget.
Great. Well, I want to thank you all for coming, and thank the three of you for participating. Appreciate it. I'm asked to direct you all back to the main hall for lunch discussions.